Welcome back. It's another episode of Sacktown Talks, where we talk with Sacramento's movers, shakers, and eclectic personalities. This week, I'm pleased to introduce Barry Broom, CEO of the Greater Sacramento Economic Council. In today's episode, we talk about keeping Sacramento and California a competitive place to do business. We do so while weaving through a discussion of Barry's upbringing as a trade union worker in Columbus, Ohio. We discuss evolving values around the nature and worth of work, and even get into a little bit of politics. Thanks again for joining. I think you'll enjoy today's episode.
You and I were just talking a little bit, and I kind of think that this is an interesting thread. So if you don't mind just chatting a little bit about it. Sort of like the decline in values in the American workforce. Is that a good way to put it? Sort of, we were talking about this book that I was reading, Coming
yeah.
Apart.
Mm-hmm.
And you described your own upbringing,
mm-hmm.
you know, post-World War II father
right.
in Columbus, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
Sort of like a hardness of character and integrity and values.
Right.
You show up to work on time, no rolling in at 8:10. And there was a pride in your work product
mm-hmm.
and a sort of a dignity to that.
Mm-hmm.
When you did things right, you showed up on time. And even if you live modestly, you're kind of living by the book, and that's a good thing to do.
Sure.
I was just sort of interested in expanding on that, or sort of touching on that a little bit with you, since you're in one way or another sort of in charge of selling our competitiveness as a economic region. Right.
Right. Right.
What do you see in the workforce in Sacramento, you know, for good or for bad? How does that, you know, sort of compare and contrast to what we have to offer?
Yeah, I think our workforce, you know, the way I look at our workforce and look at California workforce, its differentiator is creativity. You know, so it's a creative workforce. But, you know, it's not a real fundamental workforce. You know, it's really not a output productivity workforce. And, you know, probably the predominantly on my team, I mean, the profile of people working for me are 28 to 32 and, you know, predominantly women, and they're very skilled, very smart, very talented. But, you know, you kind of got to draw a different kind of energy from them to get them to work. You know, a lot more explanation, not so much direction. You know, it's more of piquing curiosity than it is kind of wrapping their head around ethos. You know, where I came from, workforce ethics. So when I was in fourth grade, I was loading trucks at A&P Bakery as a spot laborer with my dad.
In fourth grade.
Yeah, in fifth grade, I was roofing. I was working on my uncle's roofing company. And I used to carry shingles, 40-pound shingles up ladders and dump them off for my uncles. And then, kind of got into junior high and became more of a normal kid.
They'd call child services.
Oh, yeah. No. I used to have my summer job in fifth grade was to carry 40-pound shingles up ladders and drop them off on my uncle's roof when they were roofing. I was a teamster at 16, and I got a job on a loading dock in west side of Columbus at Mountaintop Pies. And so I got into Teamsters. It was the Baker's Union, and I told my dad, I was like, well, hey, you know, Monday, you know, and I was a hard worker and an athlete. I said, you know, I'm going to start work Monday. And he goes, here's what you do. Here's you walk on the loading dock, you introduce yourself to the foreman. And then you ask the foreman, who's the fastest loader on the dock? And when the foreman tells you that, tell him that's the guy you want to load with. And so I was 16. I walked on the loading dock, ran into my supervisor, started my first day. And I said, who's the fastest guy on the loading dock? His name was Sparks. That's what they called him. Sparks. And so I walked up to him and I said, hey, I hear you're the fastest guy on the loading dock. He said, yeah. I said, well, I want to load with you, because it was a two-man load on 60-foot. This guy buried me alive.
My goodness.
Load his half of the truck and go, you know, have a cigarette, and I'd still be wheedling my way back. But that was a much different way to think about work. And, you know, I worked in the steel mills in college, so I burned steel for J&L Steel in Cleveland.
Where'd you go to school?
John Carroll University, a Jesuit school in Cleveland.
Okay.
So I moved to Cleveland when I was 18 and spent 17 years in Cleveland. So yeah, so when I burned steel, I loved it. You know, it was right out of Deer Hunter, if you've ever seen the Deer Hunter movie. I mean, I was literally down there with blast furnaces and slagaways. It was really cool. One of my favorite jobs in the world was working in the steel mills. It felt very American. You know, it felt very manly. You know, felt like, you know, I was living up to my sort of heritage as a Irish Catholic trade unionist, you know, burning steel in the mills.
Yeah, yeah. You felt proud of it.
Yeah, I did. I would have, you know, to be honest with you, I could have done that job my whole life and been happy.
Yeah. This this book that I'm reading, you know, I'll post like a broader book review for just my own video blog, but I just think there's so many interesting things that we can talk about, that we can talk about here. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good segue for our broader conversation about Sacramento as a competitive business region and sort of what you're seeing as us being a government town, right? One of the things that I sort of wanted to touch on was this notion that the book is called Coming Apart. And one of the ideas within the book is that, you know, folks used to sort of live in the same town. So if you looked at, Mad Men, I don't know if you ever watched that show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Watched all of it.
Yeah. So Don Draper's house, you know, he was an advertising executive, but he lived in a pretty modest house, you know, maybe not too different than this. Mm-hmm. And so he had, you know, for neighbors, trade unionists, he had folks living in, you know, working in construction with their hands for neighbors. And so they were sort of all providing for their families in whatever way they knew how. Mm-hmm. And collectively, there was some dignity in that, you know, for the advertising executive to never be so far removed from society, and for the guy who just worked with his hands. But there was dignity in sort of doing what he can, right? Mm-hmm. When I think about the current trajectory of our nature of work, right? I feel like it's sort of shifted away from that ethos, like you talked about, and a little bit more towards, maybe not so much of an emphasis for like, are you coming in right at 8 or 8:01, but more like, well, who are you as a brand to my institution? Who are, you know, especially in politics, right? Like what you've seen in the last, I think, year and a half is these staffers really start to brand themselves. You know, I am the LGBT expert. If you are an LGBT member, you want to have me. I am, you know, really well connected in the API community. If you are an API, you know, legislator, you want to have me in my Rolodex and the sort of the social clout that comes with that. You know? But there's not as much emphasis on actually getting the work done.
Right.
You know, as a government town, right? How does that affect us as your job is to bring in regional private sector development, right? Mm-hmm. How does having like the seat of government here affect us?
What's good and bad?
Okay.
You know, so I mean, one of the things with a constant changing economy, moving from industrial to digital and computers and STEM, and what's going to happen with autonomous vehicles. So we have a little bit more stability. But what we've done, I think, with the government jobs is we've used it as a crutch. So the positive is it's given us stability. The negative has been we've allowed it to become a crutch. And I would like us to embrace the stability of having 258,000 government jobs, but, you know, kick the crutch out from under us and start to, you know, emerge as an important contributor to California's success versus somebody that lives off of California's success through the government.
Yeah. So all these folks drawing down, you know, government salaries, you know, state salaries. Mm-hmm. You know, for myself, when I bought this house, I was an employee of the legislature, and so I was making, you know, a very modest living. But so is everybody else.
Right.
And one of the side effects of that is that there sort of seemed to be like a cap to what you can sell real estate around these parts for. Because if no one's making the type of salary that is really going to give you a big offer on the house, if they can't afford that payment,
right,
then that's the cap on what your home can potentially be worth.
That's right.
You know, so I got this house what I think would be a steal. But I also kind of feel like, man, if we were in any other town where people were making, you know, more like private sector salaries, there'd be more equity in the home. Mm-hmm. Does that jive with you at all? Or?
Yeah, and I think the equity isn't just in the home, but the equity in the community.
Okay.
So, you know, we've had a lot of, we're going to have a, you know, we're number two in the United States in young adult unemployment. So we have a very high young adult unemployment rate. And this is something, you know, probably a year and a half, 2 years ago when the mayor was running for office, when Daryl Steinberg was running for mayor, I started talking to the mayor about. And so, you know, one of the things that I do in my job is I try to find data that we can build on, and then I find data that we need to address. And so when you look at our community from a government town standpoint, you know, the government's not a shared economy. I mean, you have to be privileged and educated to work for the government.
You got to have your degree. You got to know how to navigate.
Degree, right. Now you must have to have a master's degree. Right. I mean, if you graduate with a degree at Sac State, you're probably going to have to go to graduate school if, you know, you want to work at a level to where you're highly compensated from a policy perspective. I mean, it's a very competitive job to get to work for the state of California now, because the pay is good, the benefits are great, healthcare is great, and, you know, people love the work. You know, it's fascinating work if that's what you enjoy doing.
Right. If you're what they call a symbolic analyst, right?
Right.
And you have to learn to navigate the civil service.
Yeah.
You have to learn to navigate the civil service system, which is not easy, right?
Right.
Let me ask you something just in terms of capturing. I'm not sure that this has been sort of something that you've thought about. There's something that I've been thinking about, and I was just kind of hoping to throw this out there, right? When I went to the East Coast I went on my honeymoon. My wife and I are interested in seeing all of America. So we rented a car in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove down to Orlando
for
a couple weeks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We stopped at some of the state capitals along the way. You tell me from the California legislature, they're like, oh my God, come on in, why don't you talk to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing you did on microbeads. Our law is a cut and paste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, energy regulation, our mm-hmm. law is a cut and paste.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like we're actually sort of like the like maybe like a creative influencer, like for all of Western society in terms of like the creating the modern administrative state. Right. And then other jurisdictions copy that. But we're not like really reaping too many of those rewards. Right. It's like kind of like this, like our gift to the world. We're not like monetizing that like that. A lot of that isn't coming back in sort of like dollars and cents to the region of Sacramento. Maybe not so much a question for you as it's just a commentary that.
Yeah, I think it's also depends on what you're talking about. I mean, I would say most people are very determined not to emulate our business environment.
Okay.
You know, so there's good and bad in that. And I think probably renewables and I think our work on climate change and our work on renewables. I think I was talking to someone today. I think I wish we celebrated the Cal State and the UC system more and reinvested in it more, because it's a really phenomenal achievement in California. And so things like what we've done in higher ed, very few people have been able to produce. I mean, it's the most successful public university system in the entire world. And people have tried to emulate it, but they haven't been able to quite do it. I think we've done a great job with community colleges. I think our work on climate change has been impressive. But, you know, we overregulate and overprescribe rulemaking on the communities of California and the system of California and the people of California. And I think that erodes a lot of civics, because you just can't sit down and put your head together and figure out what to do with the river, because there's tremendous regulatory interference on the river. It's one of the reasons when people get out of our airport and you see the I-5 and the 99, the reason there aren't employers all along that corridor isn't because we don't have an interesting play in the marketplace. There's so much interference on state conservation plans and regulatory issues that, you know, we've rendered some of our most important economic corridors as undevelopable. You know, so we're either going to need a public source of money to offset some of those regulatory costs, or we're going to need a restructuring and regulatory policy for us to put those jobs in the ground. And, you know, so I think, you know, if it were up to me, I would simplify California's policy infrastructure. I'd cut it in half. I'd pull it back that far. I think it's that much of an overreach.
You're definitely coming into it from one perspective. Like, you're a business guy.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I think that's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing well and what are we doing bad in terms of regulating and what types of businesses, right? Like, what does the restaurant owner have to deal with that maybe like a new tech incubator doesn't have to deal with? Like, where are these like real, like sort of pain?
Well,
like,
I mean, ask the Mulvaney's how much more money they would put in Sacramento if they didn't have to wait 3 years to go through a process to do it.
Okay.
So, you know, right now, for instance, the reports are that California's short 4 million houses. There's nothing easier than building a house and selling it from a transaction standpoint. Why are we short 4 million houses?
You're going to say it's CEQA.
It's not even just, it's everything. It's
local permitting.
And yeah. And what happens, I think, is we dummy down the pace of the community. So there really isn't any community that's operating in this really active way, because you learn that you have to be very strategic, very navigational, and you have to weave your way through the world in California. That's why we have a housing shortage, and it's a big reason why their housing prices are the way they are.
Yeah. You know, I think that the housing issue specifically is a really it's like a litmus test on sort of where you fall on the role of the state. Because, you know, one way to look at the housing issue is, you know, the environmental protections, local permitting, the timelines are just, you know, untenable. And you've created an artificial, you know, constraint on the supply of housing.
Impact fees can be $100,000 a home.
Yeah.
Hard to have an affordable house once you start with that.
Yeah. So, I think one, what I would call maybe like the more libertarian, conservative, sort of business friendly answer to that question is like, hey, get out of the way, you know, streamline local permit timelines, allow for greater densification while still, you know, providing for continuity of character for the communities. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, take these large hindrances that constrain the development of housing and let builders build. Right. So then you can have an actual competition in the marketplace, right? People can actually comparison shop,
sure,
as opposed to 20 people vying for the one apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the other side of the ideological spectrum is, well, you know, what the problems that the state create, the state can solve as well. And so you get all these affordable housing programs, right? Whether it be rent control, whether it be inclusionary housing. But I think it's a really interesting issue where, on one side, you say government get out of the way, and on the other side, you say, well, just more government, right? What does that do to the local economy when you know, folks in their 30s who should be like really having a lot of disposable income, you know, half of it's going to the rent?
Yeah.
What does that do to your business districts?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple things. I mean, if you look right now, rental prices are very high. You know, they're rising in Sacramento. We have 25,000 people moving here every year now from San Francisco. So why wouldn't you be building homes like crazy right now and building multifamily units? We had before KJ left the mayor's job, you know, he put a 15,000 housing unit plan together for Sacramento. I mean, we could build 6,000 houses at the rail yards. So, you know, the demand's there and the disposable income's there to create housing. You know, why isn't there more housing? And, you know, if you take the Bay Area, one bedroom apartment in the Bay Area, $650,000 to construct. Well, you know, if you're going to go through a 2-3 year planning process, you might not be able to time the market. And then no scenario is going to ever bring affordability back to San Francisco if a one bedroom costs you $650,000 to construct. So to me, you know, I learned a long time ago, being an Ohio guy, right? So I'm from Ohio. I was the CEO 6.5 years in Michigan. You know, Detroit's gone. You know, Flint's gone. Michigan, you know, has a new normal. Ohio has a new normal. They'll never be the states they were 30 years ago. Never even close. Never, ever, ever be those states again. And that's a tragedy. And there's a lot of reasons why they won't. But one of the things that happened in the 70s and 80s in Ohio and Michigan is we had very big government policies. We were labor states. You know, I mean, I belonged to 5 unions. Yeah. By the time I was 32 years old, I was in 5 unions. My dad was a shop steward. My mom was a shop steward. I mean, we weren't just carrying a union card. We were active.
You're about the life.
Yeah. I mean, I've been on picket lines. To this day, I won't cross a picket line. You know, I mean, it would be a heretic in my home for me to cross the picket line. So if I was walking into a business and there was a real picket line, I don't mean the kinds we make up now, but a real picket line, I wouldn't cross it.
Wow.
And so to me, you know, if I look back in Ohio and Michigan, we never saw a business's perspective. We always saw
labor.
We always saw labor's perspective. I mean, General Motors came into the mayor's office. We couldn't wait for them to leave to call the United Auto Workers to tell them what the conversation was. So we were out of balance. There wasn't anything wrong with us being pro-labor, but we should have been listening to General Motors. So 1998, I did this.
To make the whole thing like economically sustainable.
We were fed one-sided information and we had a one-sided view. And I can remember in 1998, I did a major project with General Motors and we built their supply chain out. This is 98. Sounds like a long time ago, but it really isn't, 20 years ago. And General Motors was lending credit to their supply chain so their supply chain could get better financing to provide products and services to, you know, we were building a big GM transmission plant, several $100 million. I looked at that and I was talking to the investment banker and I said, my God, we're putting all of this on General Motors' balance sheet. And the guy went, look, General Motors is the most powerful corporation in the world. Don't worry about it. This is nothing for General Motors.
They can take it.
That was 1998. 2008, they went BK and had to get bailed out by $90 billion as part of the TARP funds. So 10 years later, this company was gone. And that's another company that's gone for good. So Chrysler, I mean, I just saw U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel has like 12,000 employees in the United States. When I worked in the steel mills, U.S. Steel had 130,000 workers in America. I mean, General Motors was 15%.
Can you say that some of that is just automation and the workforce efficiencies, frankly, outsourcing of labor? I mean,
but you know, we forced that issue on them. Okay. And I'll give you an example. Take $15 an hour minimum wage. So we already know the data's already out. You know, MIT and other groups have studied Seattle's market. So Seattle's booming and they've had a 10% drop in wages below $19 an hour. And that's after they passed $15 an hour minimum wage. So when you go to Seattle now, if you go to a McDonald's in Seattle, it's as you might think it is. You walk in, there's a 6 foot by 6 foot touch screen. You punch all the things you want. You swipe your card. You know, you pay right there. You walk over to a countertop and your food slides out.
It's a vending machine.
Yeah, it's not quite a vending machine, but you know, it's close as it can get.
Yeah.
And I go in the restaurants in Seattle and there's no employees. I mean, if you walk into a restaurant in Seattle today, every restaurant you will walk into, you will be shocked at how few employees there are. So what we've done is, and would they have automated anywhere? It's just like, Trump's goal of putting tariffs on aluminum and steel. There are no more jobs in aluminum and steel. You know, it's an automated plant. You know, a steel mill will operate with 100 people, where when I was a kid working in the mills, it might have been 4,000. So I think automation is moving some of this out. But, in California's economy is very productive. The more regulations you put on a company, the more you require the company to adapt to avoid the regulations. And right. If you're putting regulations on jobs, they'll reduce jobs and automate more rapidly. Would they get there anyway? Would artificial intelligence and machine learning wipe out all these fast food restaurant jobs in the next 10 years anyway? Maybe. But why enter into an economic package that you know is going to motivate companies to adapt and change and hire less people?
That's a compelling argument. I sort of want to think this through with you a little bit, because you just got done telling me you're a union guy.
Yeah.
And now and I get it, right? We have to look at this from the whole thing, the business model, right? The dollars and cents have to be mm-hmm. sustainable, or otherwise everyone's out of work.
Right.
Right.
Well, let me tell you, give you another story about a union guy. So what did we learn in Ohio and Michigan when we lost all these assets? Who walks into the mayor's office in Cleveland, Ohio now? The Teamsters, the United Auto Workers, the steel workers, and the CEO walk in together.
Okay.
Because they're tied to each other now.
Yeah. Now we're ready to negotiate.
Well, I mean, UAW, I think, owns 28% of General Motors now. So, you know, what I don't want to see us do in California is relearn all the easily documentable, painful lessons that the Midwest learned in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so from a trade union standpoint, you know, I'll always support a worker's right to organize. But what I learned in Ohio and Michigan, when the plant closed, everybody went with them. And, you know, the steel workers, when I was 31 years old, there was a guy named Frank Valena, and he was right out of Central Casting. He always had a broken nose. He always had black eyes. He was president of the steel mills, steel workers. He'd get in fist fights in parking lots.
That's a delicate.
Oh, he'd get in a fight, drop the hat. And I loved him. Frank Valena was his name. He was a great guy and a great man. You know, you could put the United Steelworkers labor office, you could put it in a phone booth now, you know. And this guy, you know, when I was 31 years old, he was one of the people that had a huge hand in me having a career because he liked me. And, you know, if I needed help with something, all I had to do was go see Frank, and Frank could make a phone call. Frank made a phone call in 1992 in Cleveland, Ohio. Stuff happened.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, I worry about the removal of the labor community in the industrial trades, and then having that shift over to the public labor. So like SEIU and unions like that are very powerful in California. Well, in Ohio, we were industrialists. So those were, you know, we didn't even really, to be honest, we didn't even consider the public unions unions.
Got it.
You know, if you weren't a communication worker, if you weren't a fitter, if you weren't IBEW, if you weren't out on the street, you know, we used to say, you know, if you weren't Jimmy Wiggins, you know, if you weren't a guy out on the street making a living, like, what? Some guy sitting behind a government desk is joining a union? Yeah, okay, great. You know, if it boosts the PAC money for the AFL-CIO, but it wasn't something that anybody admired or thought of. I mean, this is supposed to be about workers getting equal access to pay and protection. And, you know, you already have civil service and other things. So I worry a little bit that $15 an hour minimum wage, you know, a lot of it is being driven by people that aren't
the public sector unions.
They're not in the marketplace living and dying with their mistakes.
So SEIU driving $15 an hour, you know, minimum wage, those aren't, I mean, not to put it callously, but those aren't your people.
You can't live on $15 an hour. Yeah. So when people ask me about $15 an hour, I'm trying to get a guy 30 an hour.
Yeah.
How do you get people 30 an hour for healthcare? So that's what I'm in the business of doing. You know, if you showed me how, you know, so to me, how do you get someone to $30 an hour with healthcare? They got to be trained. They got to be skilled. And so really it's about your ability to create your skills and bring skills to people. And when you bring skills to people, we just got through talking about work ethic. You can't find welders. Welder make $70,000 to $120,000 right now in Sacramento. Diesel mechanics, $120,000 and up. Really skilled commercial drivers, can't even find them. So there's a lot of good, high-paying jobs that don't require you to go to college that are in this market and markets across California, but we're not training people for it. And if we were training people for those trades, we wouldn't be talking about $15 an hour because somebody's making $70 to $100.
Okay, let me take it all the way the other way then. Should there even be a minimum wage?
Yeah, I do. But I think it should be national.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I think there should be. Yeah, absolutely. I support minimum wage. And I think I would not support it for the city. You know, so I think when Mayor Johnson was looking at Sacramento having a minimum wage, that would have been a devastating blow to Sacramento's economy. And I don't know, by the time it rolls out in California, 2021, whatever the years are. But here's the other problem with the minimum wage law in California. How does Redding, California, and San Francisco have the same minimum wage?
Well, that's exactly why it should be maybe based on locality.
Well, that's what they did in New York. So yeah. Buffalo's minimum wage is not the same as New York City's. So, you know, a national minimum wage, $10 or $12 an hour, you know, I'd be for it.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I would be for that.
God, there's so much to unpack there. I hope that I'm given that issue the sort of the discussion it deserves. I think it's interesting to hear that the industrialists didn't really see themselves as sort of, you know, one for all for one with the public trade unions, with mm-hmm. the public unions.
Mm-hmm.
I'd not heard that perspective before, frankly, probably because I've not really been a union guy myself, mm-hmm. aside from understanding their influence in the legislature.
Well, I'll give you an example. Take California labor laws,
yeah,
which are a real problem. And they're costing people a lot of jobs in this state. The labor laws in California are the single biggest problem for creating mid-tiered employment. And if you look at the labor laws in California, tech's exempt from them. So what does that tell you? you know, I mean, Google's not Google, Apple, Salesforce, Twitter, Facebook. They have no litigious exposure for labor laws. So evidently, if you write code, you can work 14 hours a day without lunch break and there's no exposure. But then they go into, you know, communities like Salinas, which, you know, live and die, Fresno, live and die with mid-tiered labor rates so people can live. And those employers are getting hit by lawsuits, and they're paying $2 to $4 million a lawsuit over things like lunch breaks. So if you're getting ready to put 500 jobs in the ground, 1,000 jobs in the ground for working men and women at a working man and woman's pay, say it's, you know, $45,000 to $68,000 a year, are you going to risk a $4 million lawsuit payout in California? Or are you going to skip over and do that in Reno, wipe out your corporate income tax and wipe out your personal income tax? So, and this is the other this. So why are those labor laws like that? They're being pushed by public unions, not private unions. Mm-hmm. And you know, when go look, go at
what's the public union's stake in that?
I don't think any of them really have a stake in it. And I think it's more of an activist. I think it's probably something they believe in. They're probably not thinking about, because who's losing their job? Not union guys. You know, when Verizon pulled 1,000 jobs out of Rancho, that wasn't a union shop. Those were non-union jobs. So when those call center and back office jobs pull out of California over that exposure, that doesn't hit a trade union guy's pocket. That hits some regular guy's pocket. So back in Ohio and Michigan, when we tried to reestablish the industrial base over there, what was the very, very first thing that UAW gave up? Their work rules. They gave them all up. So UAW, steel workers, Teamsters, they gave up their work rules. And you know, when you worked in a union shop, and I worked for the Teamsters, I worked for the AFL-CIO, if you filed a grievance, your business agent from the union would come meet you, grab you by your collar, walk you into the parking lot and say, are you an idiot? You're a kid making 18 bucks an hour and you filed a grievance? Are you trying to hurt our union contract? We used to get in trouble by the Teamster business agents for filing a grievance. If you had an issue with your supervisor, your BA would come by, you know, once every 2 weeks, go over and tell your BA that you got some guy that you're reporting to that's jerking you around. The BA will walk in, the business agent will walk into the manager's desk and say, hey, I got this kid on a loading dock that says your boss is always, your foreman's always got his foot in his butt. Why don't you lighten up a little bit? And that's how it got settled. But, you know, so why were the union reps telling us in Ohio and Michigan not to file grievances? Well, when plants consolidated, guess what the plants were that were first to close? It was the one with the highest rate of grievances. So if you were papering up your union with grievances, all that did was lead to a plant closure. And union guy would tell you, and if you had a problem, you went and saw the business agent. The business agent went and saw the manager, and your supervisor got brought in and said, lay off the guy. You're riding him too hard, or whatever your issues were. So by time, I'm going to say late 80s, all the work rules were gutted in the Midwest by all the industrial trades, because what they wanted to protect was their wage, their health care, and they didn't want their plants to close.
Right, right. You were talking earlier about, you know, this story that, hey, Ford can, you know, GM can take it to the biggest, you know, the biggest mm-hmm. Company in the world. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that same narrative being sort of put out there about California? Don't worry about it. The business here can take it. Don't worry about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I will tell you the real threats. The threats to California's economy. And you know, if you talk about the economy, everybody gets mad at you because you don't land on anybody's side. Yeah, I support a national minimum wage. Well, that'll make all the business guys mad. And I support the industrial trades. Well, that'll make the public union guys not like me. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, there's always somebody out there that doesn't like the truth, which is why the American public is so misled by policymakers. So Trump's doing a really disservice to the economy, doing tariffs on aluminum and steel. You know, he's doing the economy a real disservice by threatening trade wars with China. You know, even and you're going to have a trade deficit when you're, you know, 5% of the world's population and 35% of the economy, you're going to always have a trade deficit. Doesn't mean those trade.
There's no way not to.
There's no, how are we not going to have a trade deficit with China? You know?
Yeah. They make everything.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And so, so you're always going to have that. So here in California, it's really, it's not the cost of doing business. It's the interference of people doing business. And what's going on in our state that's really concerning is, you know, where's our K-12 system ranking in the United States? It's 47th. California's own data on our K-12. So if I were to, so forget the word California. I'm going to explain a place to you, right? And here's this place. We'll call it whatever. Whatever'sville, USA. They're 47th in education out of 50. They got the highest poverty rates in the country. They got the highest taxes, the most difficult regulations. They've underinvested in their physical infrastructure. Their physical infrastructure is visibly crumbling. And nationally, they're generally considered the worst place in the world to do business. Without knowing the name of that place, would you describe that a place that's going to survive economically?
No. My question is, how do you... You don't sound like the top salesman for this place, Barry.
I'm just kidding.
You sound down on it.
I'm not down on it at all. Those are facts. You know, when you
how do you bring people here?
Obviously, you don't. That's not the conversation you have with the CEO.
Yeah.
But just so you know,
you don't put that in the Amazon bid.
No, but you know what? But Amazon knows that data.
Yeah.
So what people don't realize is every company reads that data, and we have a bill tomorrow in front of the legislature to help them see that. You know where you know. Yeah, so California's economy
2596.
Yeah,
maybe 25.
Yeah, so California's economy is very profitable and very productive, and you know we have a very strong immigrant workforce. We're highly skilled, you know, we're young, we got great demographics, and we drive you know most innovation in the U.S. and you know we produce the most creative companies in the world, and we overcome those statistics by producing that. But broader economic well-being isn't positive in California. And most states are spending a lot of their time, you know, benchmarking themselves against California and doing a very good job at convincing companies to move out of California. So the way you work an economy is you work an economy. You know, great community college system, make it better. Strong higher education system, make it better. You got an infrastructure problem, fix it. If your schools are 47th, don't just fund them, but reform them. You know, and if you've got something like an antiquated old school New Deal mindset in your labor laws, go clean them up and do the right things. And, you know, you can still have friends in labor and not be able to do every single thing they want you to do. Because at the end of the day, you know, if we're not creating jobs, we can't help our friends in labor, can't help inner city kids, we can't help young adults. So if you went into Austin right now, so I'll give you two communities. I know them both very well. Seattle and Austin. What do you think Seattle's doing right now? Do you think they're patting themselves on the back? I mean, if you had a California mindset.
Yeah, I'd say they're patting themselves on
the
back.
They're not patting themselves on the back. They're very hard on each other.
Okay.
If you talk to a Seattle official, the first thing they'll tell you is, we just got lucky. Bill Gates moved here and Jeff Bezos moved here. And we haven't done any of this stuff. Okay. And they will immediately start to talk to you about their problems and what they ought to be doing different and about who in their community is being left behind and what's wrong with their future and why they should be changing this. I've met with a lot of Seattle leadership. They talk, if you talk to them one-on-one, they sound like they're tanking. Just the opposite.
Okay.
If you go to Austin, you'll have the same conversation. So the irony is the communities that have the most exceptional economies are the people that are hardest on themselves about the state of their economy. The people that end up slipping are the people that buy into these narratives that are insulated from the marketplace, that things are always going to be well. And I use this analogy talking to people in California. When I gave you that story about General Motors, another narrative that we had in the late 80s with GM, Ford, and Chrysler was when they started building plants in Mexico, we sat down with them and said, look, when some soccer mom's going 75 miles an hour, you know, on the I-70 from Cleveland to Detroit, and the wheels fall off that minivan because you built it with dollar an hour cheap labor in Mexico, your lawsuits are going to be unbelievable and the American people are going to turn on you. That was one. And the other was, since our dads all fought in World War II, no one would buy Japanese products long term. As soon as the U.S. corrected and started making the right vehicles, not the 8 cylinders that were getting $9, you know, 9 gallons or 9 miles to a gallon. As soon as the U.S. Car makers pivoted, people stopped dropping. It's never happened. I mean, more Toyota, you know, Toyota has the market share in the United States. So here we are, we buy Japanese products. We didn't think that was going to happen. And the most efficient and productive plants for quality are usually in Mexico or China, not in the U.S. So that workforce, you know, Mexico's producing, you know, incredible amount of engineers every year. You know, India graduates 2 million PhD computer science engineers every year. So resting on your laurels and overlooking your problems and not challenging yourself is never something you should be doing.
Let's talk about that a little bit, though. Mm-hmm. It used to be sort of like one of our saving graces was, hey, where do they all want to come?
Right.
They want to come here, right? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, my wife and I went to Bali last year.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful, wonderful place. Miss it, want to go back. We were taxiing, you know, from one end of the island to the other, just kind of partying. And what do you know? They have a soft rock station in Bali, you know, and the taxi driver was just kind of humming along to whatever. I think it was Van Halen, right? And it hit me then, like, California is one of our main exports is we're the cultural center of the world.
Absolutely.
You know, everyone wants to be Californian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's kids in Bali walking around with, you know, shirts that said Malibu surfing, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So I think one of our saving graces is that those 2 million Indian engineers, they want to come here.
Absolutely. That is our saving grace.
Yeah.
Which is why you can't rest on that, because you have a president who's not embracing immigration, right?
Yeah.
So the reason the Midwest never came back is, you know, when the Midwest started to deteriorate economically, you know, they created race and class issues between people, which led to affirmative action and minority set-asides and EEOC standards being gutted. And now after they drove people apart by race and class, you know, the narrative now in Ohio and Michigan is immigrants took all of your jobs in Mexico.
Right.
So, you know, so the very thing that Ohio and Michigan needs, which is massive immigration.
They need new blood.
Your demographics don't work. So if you go in the Silicon Valley, I mean, Silicon Valley is driven by immigrants, yeah. 60% of the IP. So the strengths in California are still there, but the fundamentals are deteriorating. And, you know, we need to start to address those fundamentals. And just like General Motors, just like the steel mills, just like, you know, Yahoo, just like Facebook, just like anybody. Yeah, you're never good enough to rest on your laurels. There is no company, there isn't any place in the world, California included, or the United States, that's strong enough to rest on laurels and allow fundamentals to get away from us.
Yeah, yeah. Good analogy there. So, you know, as a lifelong, you know, 15-year wrestler, you got to go back to those fundamental moves, right?
Yeah,
your double leg, your single leg,
your
basic head position, your hand fighting. It's all,
I mean, the number one move in an NCAA championship
still a double leg.
Is a double leg or a single leg.
Yeah.
The very, you know, when you get a kid in fourth grade that wants to come out for wrestling, you teach him a stance, a single leg, and a double leg. You watch now. They're a little. The NCAA finals were a lot more exciting now.
The sports
opening up a little bit more. But you know, when you won a championship match, you know, it was all down to singles and doubles.
Yep.
And first move on bottom.
Yep.
And that's, you know, guys are still winning championships with that today. You know, Kyle Snyder. You know, I'm an Ohio guy, so you know, he won 3 NCAA titles. I mean, it was 3-2, 3-2, 3-2. You know, you know, 4-3, and won the Olympic title 2-1. You know, so you know, these guys win championships on a point, and they do that by, you know, being great on fundamentals. And you know, John Wooden, you know, UCLA basketball, great on fundamentals.
Yeah.
And so to me, you know, if we can get great on fundamentals in California, we'll be able to bring economies to Fresno and Bakersfield and Riverside and strengthen ours and have government be part of our economy, not be an economy we live off of.
Let me just quickly touch on the wrestling thing.
Sure.
Think it's, you know, because we're both grapplers. I just find this interesting, and I hope folks listening can just appreciate this. I think one of the interesting things in wrestling right now is the influence of Brazilian jiu-jitsu and wrestling, mm-hmm. and grappling, right? Because like a lot of the American Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu core has really just been kind of old guys who kind of kept wanting to grapple, and hey, BJJ is right there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in this last year's NCAA finals, oh my God, we started seeing some moves. It was like, hey, that looks like maybe borrowed from BJJ.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you're seeing like some really slick moves, like some real like kind of mm-hmm. funky type of rolls, like almost like mm-hmm. Ben Askren-esque type of stuff. How about
Bull Nickel?
Yeah.
Right. Holy cow.
I mean,
that was the craziest move I ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I wouldn't hit that move in my living room.
No.
Let alone for the NCAA title and the national team championship.
Yeah.
Everybody should go online and watch Bo Nickel's NCAA final match at Penn State. I'm an Ohio State guy.
Yeah.
But
that role he hit, right?
That was unbelievable. That move was unreal.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. So it's opening up, right? Like the sort of like the panoply of techniques is sort of in wrestling is opening up, right? Let me draw a broader metaphor there. Is the panoply of sort of like offerings in the state of California is opening up, right? Like we're not making stuff with our hands anymore.
Right.
You know, we're sort of in this knowledge economy.
Right.
You are our head cheerleader. You just sort of talked a little bit about what our environment is like. And I asked you to sort of give it to us straight. So, but what are you putting in the Amazon bid? Like what are we doing right? You know, I just saw this morning that we're the fifth largest, the fifth fastest growing economy in the United States. And if we were a country, we're like the sixth largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
So what are we doing right?
I mean, I think inclusion and tolerance, has been a very powerful value that has really made California's culture economically work.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that, and maybe it's the wrestler in me that I'm edgy like that, but people are moving to Texas. I've been working on this company in Castro that has to move out of Castro, and they have rainbow flags all around their building. Very successful company. I won't mention their name. I wasn't presuming that the leadership of the team was LGBTQ, but you know, they certainly are embracing it. They're in Castro and they're moving to Texas, right?
Okay.
Moving to Texas because of labor laws. And so I'm talking to, you know, some founders, ex-Google guys in Castro with 200 employees relocating to Texas. Imagine that, right? So I got an audience with them.
Build this wall. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just told them, I was like, well, you know, these rainbow flags are going to have to come down if you go to Texas. You know, I don't care where you go in Texas. If you go to Austin, fine, but, you know, don't get a flat tire 15 miles outside of Austin. You know, Texas is very intolerant. I'm surprised, though, but if you look at Google and Apple and Facebook, they're all making big investments in Texas. So somewhere along the line, the culture of California that works, you know, the companies that have benefited from it. I mean, I'd like to see companies in California care more about California. You know, I think these firms are global and they don't think of California as part of their requirement. But okay. I mean, I think the culture of California, the higher education system, the community college system, and, you know, obviously it doesn't hurt having, you know, one of the most beautiful places in the world to live in.
Yeah.
You know, so San Diego is, you could say San Diego is the most beautiful community in the world. And while they're at it, they do $4 billion in science research. And you can talk about L.A. I love L.A. I mean, a lot of people don't like L.A. in Northern California, but I love L.A. I love the Los Angeles culture. And, you know, you got the biggest seaport in the U.S., you have, you know, one of the most powerful airports in the world. You have one of the most, it's the 13th biggest economy in the world on its own, LA. So, you know, we're lucky we have these things. San Francisco is a brand around the world. You know, certainly not in the next 10 or 20 years will we replicate Silicon Valley. Austin's starting to show some signs, and Seattle a little bit. So, you know, this culture of openness and creativity and enlightenment has allowed everybody to come here and be themselves. And
people just want to come here.
Yeah. And you get to be yourself here. You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the things that makes me proudest of California, that it's a place where you can be yourself. And you know,
place for you and me.
Yeah. It's a place for everybody. Yeah, you know, I think that's wonderful. I mean, I think it's, you know, the inclusion and the eclectic nature of the state's culture is what I love most about it. And that's why I came to California and to Sacramento was, you know, to really fight for California's future and fight for our future, because who replaces us in the world? You know, so it's not just the economic output. You can create a lot of jobs outside of California, but where's the cultural center of America going to be? Where's the leading edge of what's right? Where's the leading edge of what's new? You know, who's going to, I mean, even climate change, which, you know, I would like to see more practicality in our regulations, but I'm really proud of the fact we're the only people in the United States talking about climate change. And, you know, that's something I think everybody can be proud of.
Okay. I'm going to go back to something that you talked about earlier, since you have so many insights into the union mindset, right? I kind of wanted to talk about this with regards to Trump. I think for a lot of sort of like Democratic Party insiders, there's a real fear when Trump came into office that he was going to steal the union base,
mm-hmm.
right? Because some of those, I mean, you said it very clearly, like he's really going to hurt our economy with the, you know, if he does decide to enact a trade war, right?
Right.
But, you know, there was a number of unions, you know, leading him along saying, hey, pull us out of TPP. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, let's renegotiate NAFTA.
Bernie Sanders said that
yeah,
too.
Yeah. I mean,
Elizabeth
you know,
Warren.
He had Hillary Clinton saying that, but, you know, he dragged the whole conversation, you know, in that direction. I think there was a fear that, you know, a lot of this was sort of like carrying the union guy's message, you know, and that if he were to sort of steal that base from the Democratic Party, we'd never get it back, right? It doesn't seem like he's been able to do it. But was there sort of like a sense of like, hey, this guy's gonna deliver for us from a union perspective?
Well,
I'm not asking you to like defend Trump or anything.
You know. I mean, I think I'll tell you what, obviously, you know, Comey was a disaster, you know, on both sides. You know, I don't have a lot of affection for Comey, you know, and I don't think how he's handled himself the last few days has added any value to anybody's opinion of him.
He's an FBI director on TV.
Yeah. Well, not just that, but covering himself and talking out of both sides of his mouth. And whatever he did to Hillary Clinton or whatever he did to Donald Trump, you could see he lost his way and he just wasn't, you know, there something happened to him where he didn't use good judgment. I thought an interview by Chris Christie was very interesting, who worked for Comey. But going back to Trump, when I was working in Ohio and Michigan, I'm an older guy. So going back to Reagan and Bush and even Clinton, you know, I don't think anybody can understand the depth of despair that has occurred in Ohio and Michigan and in West Virginia. You know, Cleveland, Ohio has infant mortality rates that are worse than third world countries.
Oh, my goodness.
So one of my proteges is in Flint, Michigan right now trying to turn their economy around. He just texted me. He wants me to help him with the water issue in Flint, Michigan. They don't have clean water. So imagine living in a place where you can't even shower your child without having lead-based paint or some type of toxicity impact them. And that goes on, and neither your governor nor your president comes in to do anything about it. I mean, imagine being treated like an animal like that. And that's what happened in Ohio and Michigan. You know, we just slowly deteriorated and went away.
Got left behind.
I never even had anybody even try to help. There wasn't even really an attempt to help. Well, we had empowerment zones under Clinton. You know, we got some workforce training stuff. You know, they gave us these miserable grants. The worst thing in the world to do is retrain an auto worker. You know, I mean, it's the worst thing in the world to do. I mean, I didn't know what post-traumatic stress disorder was, but when I was working in Ohio and Michigan in the 90s, one of the things that I kept saying was, somehow we need to psychologically evaluate these folks that have had their plants closed. Because when I would work to try to train them, they were so damaged. It was unbelievable. And we didn't, you know, Iraq came up with the PTSD term. But there's no question in the 80s and 90s, the working men and women of Ohio and Michigan and West Virginia and Illinois and Pennsylvania were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, from having their whole world taken from them literally overnight with no hope to change that. And who said a word about it? No one said a word about it.
Yeah.
But what Donald Trump did is when he started talking about the carrier jobs. And this is, if there's a Democrat listening to this, listen to this very carefully. I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton or Tom Steyer for anything ever because of how they talk about coal miners.
Okay.
I've heard when Hillary Clinton said, I'm going to put those coal miners out of their jobs. That like, was
hey,
like,
that's my family.
Well, it's beyond that. Yeah. That would be like saying, you know, I'm going to keep those refugees in Aleppo until they all starve to death. Yeah. That is the exact same
except
statement.
Except you're saying it about Americans.
Even if yeah. you said it about people in Aleppo, it would be, yeah. should be unconscionable. You shouldn't be able to hold office. And I've heard Tom Steyer talk about that. And I know he's probably done some good things in his life. But when she said that, I couldn't believe it came out of her mouth. Now, and then Trump started talking about fighting for carrier jobs. And the transition, I will tell you, she lost that election because Trump saw the struggling workers in the Midwest, and she did not. And the reason she didn't is Barack Obama did not see those workers, even though he was from Chicago. And Bill Clinton did not see those workers, even though he was from a little place called Hope. And George Bush didn't see those workers. And Ronald Reagan saw them a little bit, you know. But, you know, the depth of despair of people living in those communities in Ohio and West Virginia. And I'll close by one more thought. So one of my little, you know, when you leave the Midwest, wherever you're from, it pulls on you forever.
I'll bet.
I mean, Ohio still pulls on me. I still feel like it's got a hold of my shirt tail saying, you got to come back here. You know, and I may do that. I may go back to Ohio someday and try and do something. I may not. It's also culturally very different. I'm very uncomfortable in Ohio.
Okay.
You know, because it's so polarized by race and class. I don't feel good in that environment, but I might go back someday. Who knows? So my fallback position was, you know, my aunts had farms in Southern Ohio. Was, you know, I'm going to get a farm in Ohio, or I'm going to get a, you know, cabin in Marietta, Ohio. You know, I drop 50 grand on something. That's how cheap everything is. And just have a place I can go hang out in the summer. And, you know, there are now Mexican cartel, gang-style murders in rural Ohio over opiates, marijuana, and other drugs.
Xanax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the opiate addiction is so powerful in Ohio, so all-consuming. It leads the U.S. in opiate addictions now. That the mortality rate of Americans has dropped. You know, the age expectancy of Americans is in decline.
It's dropped for the first time ever.
Because of 200,000 opiate deaths, and Ohio leads that. So here's this great state that was God bless America and born on the 4th of July and all the things and World War II vets and trade unionists and make cars, make steals. You know, now, you know, I would be afraid to live in rural Ohio. That would make me afraid to live there.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. It is heartbreaking. And so when you look at Trump, I mean, you know, awkward as he is, inappropriate as he is, he was the first guy in my lifetime that saw those workers.
He said, hey, no one's talking to these people.
Well, then he went down to West Virginia and he talked to coal miners about saving their jobs and about how he wants to bring coal back. None of those things make any sense. They're not really environmentally correct. And, you know, they're not even economically feasible.
Yeah.
That's what people want to hear in a foxhole. Well, yeah, but right. They're in a foxhole. And I saw a guy in Wisconsin, you know, every now and then the news stations go back and let's interview Trump supporters we interviewed before and see what they think today after he, has not been handling the presidency the way anybody would have hoped, even his own supporters. And there was a guy in Wisconsin being interviewed and he said, yeah, I voted for Trump. He goes, imagine if you're me and you live in this town and all the jobs are gone and some guy comes in and throws you a lifeline and says he's going to do something about it. What did I have to lose but to vote for him? Yeah. And I really think that's a message I hope, you know, Gavin Newsom hears or Villaraigosa is that, you know, the Democrats, I mean, you know, my parents were Democrats. We're Irish Catholic trade union, you know,
what
we
else could
JFK,
you be?
Bobby, I can tell you anything you want to know about the Kennedys. You know, there's not a single, I can tell the Kennedys about the Kennedys. If I met a Kennedy, I'd probably know more about their family than they do. And, you know, we literally were brought up to worship Bobby and Jack Kennedy. They were Abe Lincoln and George Washington and James Madison all rolled in, Thomas Jefferson all rolled in the one. So, you know, that's how we grew up. That's what we thought. That's what we knew. That's what we understood. But, you know, if you go look at Bobby Kennedy and you see those photos of his career, what is he doing? He's walking through the coal mines of West Virginia with his sleeves rolled up.
Yeah.
You know, he's sitting on a porch with a dirty, filthy worker, not in the right conditions. Talking. He's not hanging out with SEIU who are going to work in ties and shirts and got civil service protection. You know, he's sitting around with people that are living and dying with the marketplace. And that's what FDR did. And that's what LBJ did. And that's what built that working base for Democrats. And then slowly but surely, you know, as that job got harder to do, it was easier for Democrats to fall on identity politics and not really talk about real economics. And I don't know a single Democrat in the United States of America that I can honestly tell you I admire on an economic conversation. And I really can't even say there's one. I mean, outside of Daryl Steinberg and some of my friends, you know, I really can't think of a national figure in the Democratic Party that I can honestly say I admire. And even though I'm very, but I admire John McCain, and I know John McCain, and I admire Jeff Flake, and I admire Lindsey Graham. Yeah. I admire John Kasich. What a lot of people don't realize is John Kasich and Jeff Flake and Lindsey Graham and John McCain, they've ended their careers challenging Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Who in the Democratic Party that you know
threw themselves up against the wall like
would
that?
End their career over? I mean, yeah, Jeff Flake's in his late 50s. He was a star in Arizona. Yeah. His approval rating is like 14%. The Republicans hate him because he's not a Trump guy. I was in Arizona 10 years. The Democrats hate him because he's a conservative. So everybody hates him.
He's done.
Yeah, he's done. And you know what? He's walking out with his chin up. And I really respect Jeff Flake for falling on his sword rather than saying, well, I'm going to pivot over to Donald Trump and hang around.
Yeah.
You know, he did what he thought was right. And McCain's that way, Graham's that way, John Kasich's that way. And that's my call for Democrats. Where's the Democrat that's going to walk in?
Stand up to identity politics.
Stand up to identity politics, yeah. You know.
And identity politics, I just, as someone, you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm just to tell you a little bit about myself. Mm-hmm. I am I was born in Mexico. I was brought over like this. My first memories were formed in San Diego in a little town called Escondido. Okay. What else could I be but a Democrat, right? I mean, just from an immigrant perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But don't, you know, like right now the Democratic Party is caught up in this like fetishization. They fetishize victim status.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why they're losing the Asian vote. Mm-hmm. You're telling these families that stuff themselves into shipping containers.
Yeah.
You know, to come over from Vietnam and Korea and wherever.
Well, why
you
aren't Latinos voting exclusively for Democrats now?
Because they're not victims, because they don't see themselves as victims.
Right. They're workers.
I'm not a victim.
I was in Arizona 10 years.
Yeah.
So I worked on immigration issues in Arizona. And the Latinos, you know, they're an amazing culture.
Yeah.
You know, faith, family, work. You want to talk about old school work?
Old school America.
They will work your butt into the ground.
Yeah.
And I used to coach high school wrestling in Phoenix. I loved coaching Latino kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kids just went, and great students.
Yeah,
they were fantastic, you know, fantastic kids. It was a beautiful thing. One of the greatest rewards of my life was being in Arizona 10 years and watching the rise of the Latino culture. It was something that I had so much admiration for. So to me, it's like, hey, you know, let's just start doing the right things. Nobody's that important. I'm not that important. I mean, I'm not that important. I mean, keeping me around is not that important.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to push hard and try to do the things that are right for the community because, you know, by pushing hard and doing my best to do the right things for the community, that's the only thing that I create value by doing.
Yeah.
I'm not valuable. You know, if I start worrying about myself, my own identity, my brand, my own preservation, hey, I should go sell real estate or go move money around or go be an investment banker, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I should take my business skills into the marketplace and try to make a living. You know, I shouldn't be sitting around representing my community with a mind towards my own self-preservation. And I don't, and I never have. And I think it's one of the reasons why I've been effective. I pay attention to the work, what's good for the community. I pull the trigger. I try to be smart about it. You know, I don't want to self-destruct. You know, I want to be successful and, you know, need to make a living and raise my family. But the community always comes first for me. And, you know, I think the Clintons, I think we fell prey to the Clintons' machine politics, and I just think it was distasteful. And I think many of the criticisms of the Clinton were in fact true. And then when you get beyond the Clintons, I mean, I liked Bernie Sanders a lot. I met Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Before she was Elizabeth Warren.
Okay.
Do I got time to tell you this story?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, we're on your timeline.
This is a cool story. And it's a sad story. So I'm going to say it's maybe 2009. And Elizabeth Warren gets appointed.
Before she.
This consumer protection affairs bureau. Head, yeah. Right? So I'm going to Washington, D.C. with a bunch of bank presidents. You know, Arizona got blown out. We had 200,000 houses go BK. You know, the state law. I mean, 54% of Arizonans in 2009 had negative net worth because of their house.
Yeah.
That's a crash. So I go in and, you know, we have this D.C. trip that we do. And it's all business. It's not as flamboyant or fun as Cap the Cap, which is going on right now. And I got a chance to meet Elizabeth Warren. 2-hour meeting with Elizabeth Warren. Never heard of her before. So I was a Democrat my whole life. I'm more of an independent now, but you know, okay. I was a Democrat, worked for Democratic mayors in Ohio. I was a labor organizer. So, you know, I was
what else
a
could you be?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So I go and I get this 2-hour meeting with Elizabeth Warren. Didn't know her from Adam, never heard her name before. So I grabbed these three bank CEOs, like, you know, and we're in D.C. And I'm like, come on, I'm going to take you to this meeting. We're going to talk about the housing crisis with this new head of consumer affairs named Elizabeth Warren. And they were like, oh, my God, we're not meeting with Elizabeth Warren. I'm like, why not? We've heard she's awful, that she's just terrible, Barry. She's going to be terrible to work with. I said, well, you never met her before. Let's go meet her. So I walk in and I meet with her, right?
Yeah.
And so I call. She picks up the phone. Well, I'm bringing these bankers over. Where do I meet? She goes, it's kind of, you get lost here. I'll meet you in the lobby. And I love watching. I keep a close eye on leaders. Whenever I meet a leader, I watch them really closely. I watch their gait, their body language, everything about them.
Right.
You know.
How they carry themselves.
Yeah, because I'm learning. I'm always learning. I mean, I'm 56, but I'm still learning, right? So I go into this lobby, and there's Elizabeth Warren, right? And I go, how do you do, Elizabeth, Barry? How do you introduce me? And she goes, come with me. Now, I don't know if you've ever, how much time you've spent in Washington, D.C., but we walk through these catacombs of federal workers in cubicles,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. It's the same up here. It's the same here.
Yeah. So I'm walking behind Elizabeth Warren, and these employees are reaching out with their hand to touch her like she's MLK.
Oh, my God.
Like she's Dr. King, you know? I'm sort of thinking, this is bizarre. I'm just walking through this, you know, dead-end bureaucratic building with this woman that I've never heard of before. But these employees are like, hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. So
she's like the king bureaucrat.
No, she took the time to learn who these employees were.
Good for her.
So they all leaned in, right? Yeah. I thought, well, this is pretty cool. You know, I've walked around with, you know, undersecretaries before and maybe a couple of cabinet members in my career, and I never saw anybody even look up. You know, D.C.'s a little cynical. So then we go sit down, and I talked to her for about an hour, hour and a half. And I thought she was the most enlightened, thoughtful, charismatic person that I couldn't remember being around. Since Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, who was a friend of mine I worked with when I was in Michigan, Jennifer Granholm was like Jack Kennedy. And when Jennifer Granholm walked in a room, the whole room changed what it was.
Okay.
I mean, very few people had that kind of lift. And she had that kind of lift. So I get done with this meeting. And I thought, my God, this is great. You know, this, I don't know who this lady is, but she's so special. And when I got done, I walked out. First thing I did, because you don't get very good cell phone coverage in these big. I walked out the door and I called my wife. My wife works at UC Davis. She's the STEM advisor to the provost.
Okay.
I called her. She picked up the phone and I said, write this name down, Elizabeth Warren. I said, I don't know what she's going to do, but I said, I will tell you, there is something really, really special about this woman. Never heard her before. So then, you know, I read where she was running for the Senate and stuff like that. And I thought, this is going to be fantastic, that this magical woman with this incredible mind and incredible charisma you know, this is what we're looking for in this country. You know, somebody new, somebody fresh, not stale, bringing something here. She didn't get along with Obama. You know, she had some problems in the party.
Yeah.
You know, she was too much of a maverick. I don't think they ever made her permanently ahead of this consumer affairs position. By the way, Richard Cordray, who just stepped down from Ohio, he's a longtime friend of mine. So she runs and she wins, right? And now I'm thinking, this is going to be spectacular. I mean, this is going to be, you know, this very rare and special leader. And I saw her at the 2012 Democratic Convention. And her message was, the system's rigged. And I sat there dumbfounded in my living room watching Elizabeth Warren in 2012 say the system was rigged and how people are being cheated and beat out of. And then Bernie Sanders ran and the system was rigged and everybody's being ripped off. And then
guess what? A losing message?
No, it was Donald Trump's message.
Yeah.
But my point being is, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders set the stage for Donald Trump to walk in. So if Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders is telling you the system's rigged, and then Donald Trump tells you the system's rigged,
okay,
well, then the system must be rigged. And the Clintons rigged it, right? Because they've been the biggest machine politicians in the last 20 years in the U.S. Yeah. And of course, Jeb Bush couldn't get 2% in an election because the Bushes rigged it.
Yeah.
So we convinced everybody the country's rigged, and that allows Trump to push the FBI around or the Attorney General, the Supreme Court or the United Nations or anything else, because they're all false institutions and they're rigged. So I'll give you another different perspective on this. So I'm a kid growing up, right?
Okay.
World War II, brother gets drafted after the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
So I got a brother that's, you know, 9 years older than me.
That's Vietnam.
Yeah. In Vietnam. Yeah. Tet Offensive was the big loss.
Yeah.
That was when, you know,
Walter. I was just rewatching Full Metal Jacket because Arlie Emery died.
Yeah. And you should read, if you haven't seen the Ken Burns series, every young person that cares about this country should watch the Ken Burns series on Vietnam.
It's amazing.
It's amazing if you haven't seen it. So my brother's going to sign up for the military after the Tet Offensive. My dad's a World War II Marine. And I can remember my dad telling my brother not to do it. And I had a couple uncles that did tours over there. My wife's uncles did tours over there. We didn't know each other then because I was 8. I can remember watching that thinking, wow, you know, I was scared to death, right? So my brother enlisted. He didn't see combat, fortunately. But so what did I start doing at age 8 or 9? You know, I'd go out and, you know, my sister would go to peace marches because I'm one of the younger of 7. And I'd go there with her and her friends. And what would they be saying? You know, Nixon stinks.
Okay.
The country stinks.
Okay.
You know, the U.S. is failing. You know, we're killing children. So I go back to my house with my parents. So I had 8th grade educations. None of them saw high school. Mom and I, you know, my grandparents are from Ireland. Mom's an Irish immigrant. And what do I do at age 9? I'm walking around the house. This country stinks.
Uh-oh.
You know,
how'd that go over?
Didn't go over very well.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I think I got the word stink out of my mouth once. All of a sudden, this big hand grabs me by my collar. It's my old man who lifts me up and turns me around and was like, so here's 2 eighth grade educated people, one a World War II Marine, both grew up in orphanages.
Oh, wow.
Not a pot to you know what in. Son drafted, did not see combat, wars dividing the country. And my parents, like, sat me down in that chair and said, you live in the greatest nation in the world. You have unlimited opportunities. The world is your oyster. This is the most just, fair nation in the world. Don't confuse that with being perfect. It is not a perfect country. But let me tell you something. I remember my dad, do you want to go to the Soviet Union and see what it's like to be a 9-year-old boy in the Soviet Union? Do you want to go to those schools? Would you like to go to China and starve to death? I mean, they just sat me on a chair and let me have it. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I want to do any of that.
Yeah.
And so I learned, you know, that I live in this great country and it's not perfect and it's imperfect and it requires all of us to challenge it. But the system is not rigged. Okay. I mean, it is not rigged. It is born.
You don't think that there's been a rigging in the system in the years following the World War II.
And I don't think there's not only is there not a rigging in the system. The system is born for people to succeed in it.
Okay.
I mean, 50% of the kids going to UC Davis are low-income kids
Yeah.
On Pell Grants.
Yeah.
So if you
grow design.
Up, if you, by yeah, design. By design, yeah. Right. If you grow up in this community and you're poor and you're going to a world-renowned institution like UC Davis for free, that's a pretty doggone good deal. And you know when you get that degree from UC Davis, if you apply yourself, do you know what your chances are of getting the six figures and a beautiful home and a nice life? Really good.
Yeah.
In fact, it ought to be automatic.
Yeah.
So when you live in a country that still gives you that path, that ought to be the message we're sending people. Because when we tear down the country, and that was my disappointment in Elizabeth Warren, and that was my disappointment in Bernie Sanders, when you tear down the country, you create the environment in which anybody can come to that mic.
And say that,
and all of a sudden...
Fill that vacuum.
Yeah.
Yep.
So all my friends, God bless America friends, they all think the FBI is rigged. Now, all my buddies from Ohio that I grew up with, well, come on, Barry, you know the FBI is rigged. All the United Nations, a disaster. I mean, all these institutions that held this community and country together is now being torn apart and disbelieved by the average American, which creates major cynicism and anger in this country. And it isn't just Donald Trump that sent that message. It was the left base of the Democratic Party that hammered it home. And it is not true.
Yeah.
And it is not true.
Just to provide a quick counterpoint, right? I think that the counterpoint to that is, you know, certainly our finest institutions, right? Like, I think our law enforcement institutions are among our finest institutions. Mm-hmm. I could never believe that they're rigged. I think that the deck has sort of gradually been stacked against folks, and it's sort of gradually gotten harder for educated and, God forbid, for even non-educated folks to get by, right?
Right.
It used to be you walked out of the CSU with maybe a couple $1,000 in student loans or not at all, you know? And now your student loan is prohibiting you from getting a mortgage, mm-hmm. right? I think that we're starting to see the rise of the nuclear family again, just because people can't afford a one-bedroom house.
Yeah.
So they're getting into domestic situations that they otherwise wouldn't necessarily get into, right? We've become incredibly productive in our workplace, but the mm-hmm. workers haven't seemed to get any of that time back in terms of, you know, wage increase or hours off.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the rise of consumer financial debt vis-a-vis credit cards, cars have gotten more expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just at every turn, it's sort of gotten harder for working people to get by.
Yeah.
I think that's the sense where people are like, oh man, this is, you know, this is rigged against me. And at the same time, the richest 1% in the world, you know, enriching themselves during this time period where everyone else is sort of taking it on the chin. I think that that consumer perspective was like, hey, I can't get by. I used to be able to know that I was going to be able to send my kids to school.
Yeah.
Now if I'm poor, I know I can send them to school, but middle class, not so much. I think that's where it came from, you know?
Yeah. But you know, here's how I would look at that again. So, I grew up in Ohio, west side of Columbus, on the hilltop. If you know anybody from Columbus, I was what they called a hilltopper. Basically, that was the Appalachian neighborhood that moved from West Virginia and Kentucky out of the coal mines to go work in steel plants and auto plants where they could make the same money and not die of a lung disease.
J.D. Vance talks about these towns in Hillbilly Elegy.
Yeah. So J.D. Vance is a rich kid, just so you know. Just so you know. I mean, J.D. Vance's grandmother took him to Dairy Queen. I mean, I had to have a paper out before I went to Dairy Queen, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
If I'd asked my grandmother to take me to Dairy Queen, you know, she'd have made me cut the grass or something. But, and here's the bottom line on this. You know, my parent, it was April of my senior year, so I was a high school All-American in wrestling. And I got recruited by Ohio State. And that was my family's dream, that I was going to go to Ohio State. But, you know, I grew up in a rough neighborhood and I knew all the kids could find me at Ohio State. And I knew if I went to Ohio State, I wasn't going to graduate and I'd have been in trouble. And, you know, because as you get to 17, 18, 19, you know, those street fights get gradually more dangerous.
Yeah,
it's no longer a bloody nose and you call each other a name. They were escalating. So I went to a Jesuit school in Cleveland, John Carey University. My mother was raised in a Jesuit orphanage. And when I didn't go to Ohio State and disappointed my dad, my mom was like, you have to go to this Jesuit school. I was April of my senior year. I was in the associate athletic director's office at Ohio State. And I've told this story to my employees and some other people. And he said, how'd you do in your college boards? And I went, my what? He said, you know, your college boards, you know, the exams you take before you go to college. And I went, I got to take an exam to get into a college. That's a true story. April of my senior year, I was senior class president. I had a, you know, 3.5 GPA. That was before people had all the AP stuff. And I'd never heard of an ACT or an SAT.
Oh,
April,
goodness.
My senior year. That's a true story. So he explained to me what these things were and that I had to take one before I went to school, right? I never saw half the curriculum, never studied for them. I didn't know there were prep courses. You know, my parents had eighth grade educations. I didn't hear that in my house. So I was working on a construction crew called All Site Development. I drove a flatbed truck and poured concrete. And so on Friday night, I had to work construction on Saturday. So the exam was from 7 in the morning to 11 or whatever it was. I drove Friday night down to where the exam was, parked my truck. I was 18. You could drink at 18. I went to a bar, drank all night, slept in the front seat of the truck, used a wind-up alarm clock. Yeah. And the alarm clock walked in. I went into my construction gear, took an ACT exam, came out, drove my truck to a job site and poured concrete for 12 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how I took my ACT. I got a 17 on it. And I had a high enough GPA to where I could still get into schools and they didn't look at school.
Okay.
But I had to take it again to get into John Carroll. And, you know, because the score was so low.
Yeah.
So, you know, my parents, you know, my dad was one of eight kids and his mother died on a kitchen table delivering his eighth brother and sister, literally.
Wow.
Died on a kitchen table. All of them ended up in protective custody. They all ended up wards of the state. My dad and his older brother joined the Marines and went to the war. His other brothers and sisters went into an orphanage. And then after the war, my dad and his brother came back and got him out. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of people starting in this world without a great set of cards. Kevin Johnson didn't have that.
Yeah.
Mayor of Sacramento. Kevin Nagel grew up with a single mom and struggled. So there's, Angelo Sakopoulos came here as a Greek immigrant and is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Vivek Ranadive showed up at Boston with $50 in his pocket, went to MIT. Now he owns an NBA team and he digitalized Wall Street. There is unlimited opportunity in this country if you lock into it. And what we need to start to tell kids and needs to start to tell people.
Let's give people hope again.
Well, and give them hope and it pays off. Hard work pays off.
Yeah.
Hard work pays off. Now, if you're going to quit the first time you take it on the chin, or if you want to read what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders says, or Donald Trump says, and you believe you can't trust the Department of Justice, you can't trust the United Nations, you can't trust the banking system. Well, if you're going to buy into that, then how are you going to flourish as an American, stepping into the fray?
So you know, to you, they're all the same.
Well, I mean, to me, it's like, hey, you know, who are you? What are you? And what do you believe in? And I tell every kid the same thing, having developed and groomed a lot of kids. And I tell everybody, I can guarantee everybody listen to this. I can guarantee them success.
Okay.
If you're a young kid, I'm going to guarantee you success beyond God stepping in and bringing you to heaven quicker than you thought. Right? I can't control the universe, but you get up every morning and you start your day early. Okay. And you outwork everybody. Okay. And you treat people with respect and dignity and you hold yourself accountable to high standards and you do that every day. And I will guarantee you, you will wake up one day in this country with money in the bank, money to invest, if that's what you want to do, a beautiful home, something for your wife, something for your husband, and something for your children. And everybody in America can get that. You can get that if you move here from India. You can get that if you move here from China. You can get that if you crawl on your hands and knees from Mexico to Arizona. Everybody can still get that if they're prepared to do what it takes to get that. If you're waiting for that to be easy, if you're waiting somebody to hand that to you,
not gonna happen.
It's not gonna happen. And you know what? We did have a generation that got to do that. It used to be, you know, if you flunked out of high school, went to jail, did a year for stealing a car and came out, your buddy could take you down to the United Auto Workers. You could fill out a job application. Somebody threw you on the line at General Motors, you know, and you made $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. Yeah. That isn't going to happen anymore.
That's over.
So now you know that. So don't go do that, right? Don't go get yourself thrown in jail.
Yeah.
You know, don't drop out of school when you're 16. Don't get your girlfriend pregnant. You know, don't do drugs, you know.
Simple stuff.
It really is. It really is. And it's supposed to be something you earn. you know, and when you earn it, you'll be able to take great pride in it because you went out and you got it on your own. And it is well within the grasp. If you live in Oak Park, if you live in South Sac, if you live in Del Paso Heights, I don't care where you live. If you live in Oakland, that American dream is right there for you. And as long as you're determined to get it, no one can stop you.
Very good. I think that's a great point to end on. The American dream is still alive.
Still is.
And well, gosh, thank you.
Yeah, and every elected official in the United States ought to be telling people that, and you'll change the course. Remember Reagan, morning in America again.
Morning in America again.
I mean, you know, whatever he brought to the presidency, what he really brought was a sense of optimism. People believed him, they followed him, and they loved him because of it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, okay. Thanks for coming on, brother.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great message.
Yeah.